Robert Hur defends himself, and Chuck Schumer wants a new Israeli government. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline Matty Kearns, and the notorious M.B.D., Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a Nash View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Donors Trust, Maiden, and Moink. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So speaking of forgetting MBD, we had Robert Hur up before a congressional committee in the House discussing his report, where he, of course, characterized Joe Biden as a well-meaning elderly man with memory issues. Also, the Department of Justice released the transcript of Hur's 2 days of interviews with Joe Biden, pretty much simultaneously with this testimony or right beforehand. I thought Hur was really an accomplished witness, very sure-footed, not, you know, a MAGA extremist or anything extreme about him, very professional. And Democrats were at pains to try to characterize his report as exonerating Joe Biden. There are at least two instances where Democrats said this. Representative Jay Paul was one of them, and she, in the course of a wind-up, I don't think it was a question, it was just a long comment, she referred to the complete exoneration. And then when she paused, he popped in and said, I just have one problem with the word you use there. And she's like, Mr. Hur, this is my time. I didn't exonerate Joe Biden. You know, I found this. Stop interrupting me. This is my time, Mr. Hur. But he rejected the idea that he had exonerated Biden appropriately.
Yeah, this was actually a surprisingly entertaining bit of testimony and back and forth. Usually these are duds, this wasn't a dud. I thought it was crazy, though, to see so many people in the print media suggest that Hur's report had fundamentally misled people about Biden's memory, specifically on when his son died. And basically, the report before we saw the transcript was that Joe Biden couldn't remember the year within a few years of in which his son died, and couldn't remember whether or not he was vice president at the time or not. That's exactly what the transcript shows, right? He's asked when his son died, and he remembers the date. I think it's May 29th. And says, oh God. But then he starts asking questions about whether he was president then, or when the election, what year the election of Trump actually happened. And doesn't seem to know, with any firmness. And there are other parts of the transcript that show him stumbling over his memory and kind of seeking out help from counsel, or just, you know, being out of it. So it was an interesting hearing. I mean, it was also ridiculous because many Democrats claimed, like, oh, this is, some dastardly plot by Hur to get appointed in the, you know, future Trump administration by attacking Joe Biden, even though, you know, like I said, some of them are saying he exonerated him. But of course, like, you know, one other way of going after Joe Biden would have been to charge him,
yeah.
You know, and draw out the drama even further. Rather than to drop it and say, well, we're unlikely to get a conviction because of his mental state and how the jury will react to him. So, you know, I don't know. It was quite a bit of theater, and it was, as Washington theater goes, it was pretty good.
Yeah, so I think for everyone's purposes, you could do much worse than Robert Hur as Attorney General. You know, yeah. The Democrats probably shouldn't get him to pledge that he's not going to take a job in the Trump administration, not that he wants one. So Maddie, the transcript, I did not read the whole thing. It's very lengthy. But as MBD points out on this Bo Biden question, it's just obviously Robert Hur was right and Joe Biden was wrong in how he characterized it in his very righteously indignant press conference upon the release of the report, where he suggested Hur had brought this up. Biden actually brought it up himself. He did come up with the month and the day, but had no idea of the year. and really had no idea that the time period, you know, he made a reference in, I think, 17 or 18 that Bo Biden was either in Iraq or was dying, you know, and he was wrong on both counts. He was in Iraq much earlier, and then he passed away tragically in 2015. And then there's, you know, it's not as though Biden is incoherent in this transcript. You know, he can describe how he gets his presidential daily brief and what you do with the binder and what the binder looks like and all that kind of thing. But just incredibly meandering answers, kind of entertainingly so if you're just popping in and out, you know, reading it. But you can see how her is just, okay, sir, yeah, I know your Corvette's awesome, but that's not what I asked about. Because he asked some question, you know, about a totally different matter. And then 7 minutes later, Biden is like, have you ever driven an electric car? You know? And her is like, yeah, you know, I'd like to one day, but can we get back to what I asked you?
Yeah, the part about Bo Biden was, as Michael says, much worse than I think we initially thought. I mean, in the press conference, Biden tried to say that this was just, he was indignant about it. How dare he bring this up? But it's clear, not only did he bring it up, but he brought it up in a way that then left him completely lost. In fact, he starts sort of soliciting help from others present in the room, saying, was it 2015 he died? And then someone's like, yes, you know, it was 2015. And then he sort of asks a series of questions, and obviously her is just doing his job by observing this and writing it down. There were other parts of the transcript I think Democrats were excitedly trying to focus in on. For instance, her had said that Biden had a photographic understanding of the house in Delaware. And so they were saying, look, how can he have memory issues if he's got this great understanding of the house? But this is just totally selective because, if, as you say, if you look at the kind of broader picture here, you're seeing random just digressions or an inability to recall basic facts. I mean, and also you see that curmudgeonly instinct that we've discussed before in this podcast about him sort of saying he has no damn idea where the files are and he doesn't remember how a beat up box got in the garage, and actually just being quite rude, as is typical of somebody who is sort of old and tired and maybe not at the top of his game. So yeah, I mean, it was, I don't think the Democrats really had much to gain by defending this. They obviously tried to kind of go after Trump's age as well and sort of draw comparisons there. I mean, really, I think that the good news for them was that her did conclude that no criminal charges were warranted, and they should have kind of focused in on that rather than draw more attention to the bad news and the biggest weakness, which is that, yes, Biden has an age problem and the public are very sensitive about that.
Yeah, I mean, you can see like Biden's aides coming into him saying, sir, we need you to authorize force, you know, against the Houthis. And he's like, that reminds me of the time I went to falconeering with the Saudis and my falcon was so much better than the crown prince's. And I was really sorry for that little bastard, you know. And someone's got to fact check this Mongolia story where he's supposedly, you know, shot with an arrow perfectly, this bale of hay, totally lucky shot, you know, Biden said modestly, but then the Mongolian guy couldn't even draw back the bow. So Charlie, I think the weakest part of her testimony, because this is the weakest part of his whole conclusion, is why he didn't charge Biden. Now, I understand why he didn't want to charge Biden or recommend charging Biden. This would be a thermonuclear thing. And but it doesn't really make sense. You know, it's not the fact that his memory is bad now doesn't mean his memory was bad when he was mishandling these classified documents. And the question of criminal intent that Herr puts a lot of emphasis on is not really necessary to charge under this statute. So Republicans hammered him on that question. So in some respects, he was getting it from both sides.
And doesn't that just underscore the Democrats' problem here? That the weakest moment for her was when he had to explain why he hadn't charged Joe Biden. The problem the party has got, and this was in evidence in Congress, but also online, where all manner of people tried to spin the hearing and her's involvement in the report, is that what her said is true. Joe Biden is a mess. Nobody, from what I can see, thinks that her is some sort of political hack who is playing games. Nothing in the transcript rings false. And he is a remarkably good witness. He acquitted himself very, very well. So you have the Democrats hammering away at him, trying to undermine his central case, which is that Biden did this, but that we shouldn't prosecute him because he will come across to jurors as a kindly old man who can't remember anything. And you have Republicans hammering away at her for that decision. But neither of those hammers get you closer to a position that helps the Democrats. I'm baffled they staged this. I'm baffled they engaged. It didn't work. And it didn't work because it's true. And this is their problem with Biden. They just cannot get past the fact that everyone can see that he is old and past it. They keep trying, but they can't do it. I think this was a mistake. I think it was a mistake politically. I think it was a mistake legally. I think it highlights problems they're going to have going into the next few months. This was one of those unusual moments where a guy gets pulled in front of Congress and subjected to speeches and badgering and twisting of the truth and comes out of it completely unscathed, except in the one way that the Democrats didn't want, which was the Republican case that Biden is not, in fact, above being charged. And that's the problem the Democrats have, isn't it? That's the problem with this, logically. That if they are right, and that it's really her who forgot everything, that Biden is wonderful behind closed doors, impressive with it, cogent, then he can be charged. If they win that propaganda battle, then they have to explain after that why it is that this call was made, and they can't.
Yeah, on that right, they'll just say, well, Trump was so much worse.
Right, but Trump is being prosecuted.
Yeah, it's also obstruction, really, that's the main thing with Trump, although he's being charged more broadly. So MBD, exit question to you. None of us are going to change our fundamental views about Joe Biden, obviously, after all these decades of observing him. But the transcripts, the Herb Biden transcripts, made you feel a little more fond towards Joe Biden, even if temporarily, or a little more critical and freaked out about Joe Biden?
A little more critical and freaked out. I mean, Joe Biden's, the fondness about Joe Biden is if he were not president, if he were just a character at the local St. Paddy's Day parade, he'd be just fine. And he'd be this like loquacious guy who says things you haven't heard since the 1950s.
Charlie Smedlap.
Yeah.
Cock Robin.
But he's president of the United States, and his mind is not well. He should be resting. He should be subject to being taken care of rather than being the caretaker for the federal government.
Yeah, the way I think about it, if you were nominated as Deputy Secretary of State and went before the Senate for hearings, they'd say, no, sorry. There's no way we're giving you this responsibility. You're just not up for it. But he's President of the United States. Maddie, a little more fond or a little more freaked out?
A little more freaked out for exactly the reasons Michael just gave.
Charlie?
I think more freaked out. It's hard to psychoanalyze people you don't know, but I have to assume that the people who are doing their best Pravda routine and insisting that he's fine must, every time they lie about it, become more worried. Much in the way that somebody who is lying about their involvement in a crime must become more worried about their chances of being discovered and convicted each and every time they have to repudiate the investigator's latest discovery. I look at some of the people who were trying to spin this online, and I just see flop sweat pouring off their heads. Josh Marshall, for example, insisting that it's absolutely outrageous that Robert Hurwood suggests that Joe Biden's anything other than sprightly, pretending that the report said what it clearly didn't. Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. These people have to be crying themselves to sleep.
Yeah. And then if he wins re-election, then the 25th Amendment has to be invoked. It'll all be, we all knew this. We all needed this, knew this needed to happen. I feel a little more fond, actually, because I think he's entertaining and amusing. He has the gift of gab. He's the kind of guy, it's fun to be around him once in a while, but it must be a total bore to be around him all the time because you're going to hear all these same ridiculous stories over and over again. And I really kind of feel sorry for him on the memory stuff. But I don't think he should be president of the United States and obviously should not be president of the United States for another 4 years. With that, let's hear from our first sponsor of this episode, Donors Trust. In times of crisis, those with a giving spirit and a desire to build up civil society find ways to be helpful. And that's when it's good to have charitable resources ready to deploy where they're needed most. Donors Trust offers donor-advised funds or giving accounts. You can use these funds as your own charitable investment account and manage your charitable giving in a way that's smart, tax-advantaged, and private. Donors Trust clients are using their funds to support charities in their local communities and think tanks, preserving civil liberties, among other things. Now is the time to take a closer look at Donors Trust and join their community of liberty-minded donors by opening a donor-advised fund. Go to donorstrust.org/editors for their ultimate survival guide to charitable giving and learn how a donor-advised fund can preserve your ability to give charitably. That's donorstrust.org/editors, donorstrust.org/editors. So, Maddie, Chuck Schumer went to the floor of the Senate, a very pro-Israel Democrat, high-ranking Jewish official, and said there are four people or forces that are ruining the chances for peace. One of them is Bibi Netanyahu, also radical right-wing Israelis, as well as Hamas and Mahmoud Abbas, but called for new elections, which is just kind of an extraordinary thing. This is, allies don't do this, you know, in peacetime to one another. They shouldn't be doing it in wartime. And this isn't just Bibi Netanyahu's government anymore. It's a government of national unity. And one of the things that Democrats are most upset about, the prosecution of the war, they also want Israel to commit to a two-state solution. But the war would go on. You know, Bibi Netanyahu could just say, I'm resigning now. And the war would go on as it is now because there's a consensus in Israeli society that Hamas needs to be destroyed. But Bibi has become the scapegoat.
Yeah, it's a really bizarre thing to see. And not least because Schumer has historically been an ally of Israel's. I mean, he was one of the only Senate Democrats to vote against the Iran deal under Obama. This just shows just how much of an issue the Democratic Party thinks their progressive anti-Israel wing is, that he would stoop to this level to pander to them. It's just really bad optics to basically call for, to tell your ally that they need to change their present course, that they're going to have no choice if they don't do it, you're going to, I mean, I don't even know what the implication is there, that you're going to interfere or punish them in some way. I mean, it's just, it seems very anti-democratic for a party that's always harping on about threats to democracy. And also with the two-state solution, you know, this is, unfortunately, this is just not really viable right now. Two-thirds of Israelis oppose the idea of a two-state solution. Three-quarters of Palestinians oppose it. I mean, suggesting that another prime minister could just come in and offer a two-state solution and all problems would be solved is just like unbelievably naive. Obviously, the Netanyahu government had problems before October 7th, and now it's got a serious issue in terms of its legacy, that this great failure in security happened on their watch. But that's for the Israeli people to figure out. That is not for... that is not for Chuck Schumer, and it's not for the Democratic Party, and it's not for America.
Yeah, Charlie, so it's hard to see what the actual lever the administration is going to pull here. And if they have a red line, as we've discussed before, saying don't go into Rafah, and they Israel does because they feel it's absolutely necessary to finish the mission against Hamas. What are we going to do? You know, are we going to cut off all weapons shipments? Are we going to sanction Israel? You know, occasionally sanction West Bank settlers, but if you take this rhetoric seriously, it's just hard to see where they go with it without creating a totally politically unsustainable situation for them here at home. And that's obviously, Schumer is smart enough to know that he says this, and everyone in Israel is going to back, rally around Bibi. You know, no one wants a foreigner telling them what to do in terms of their how their government is constituted and when they should have elections. But it will play here at home the way that Schumer intends, at least among the left of the party.
I'm very disappointed, Rich, with your use of the word foreigner. No one is foreign. I can't believe that he said this. I can't believe the arrogance of it. He said, the U.S. cannot dictate the outcome of an election. Well, that's good of you to acknowledge. That's for the Israeli public to decide. As a democracy, Israel has the right to choose its own leaders, but the important thing is that Israelis are given a choice. They were. They are. What prompted that? It's such a strange thing to say. Now, I know the answer, as you intimated. This is for domestic consumption, albeit peculiar domestic consumption, given that the people at whom it's aimed go on and on and on about American colonialism and are penchant for bullying everyone in the world and trying to get their governments to do what we want them to. But what a arrogant, out-of-line comment. It seems to me that that approach gets quite close to the conflation of our democracy with outcome I like that you see domestically. The idea that there is something intrinsically undemocratic about any country having a government that Chuck Schumer dislikes. But it's empty. It's empty. It's irritating. I find it infuriating, actually, but it's empty because they can't do anything about it, and they know that. I would just say once again that I do not understand why, especially someone such as Chuck Schumer, who is better on Israel than many, are so worried about this small minority of people within the party.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder, have they got polling data that I am not privy to, that others aren't privy to, that really shows the slice of Americans who are so upset about what is happening in the Middle East, staying at home and costing Biden the election?
Yeah, it must be
odd.
It must be, you know, more than, you know, the Arab American community in Dearborn or something like that. It's got to be young people. They, you know, they've seen erosion there, and they must think that this plays into this, plays into that erosion. But, you know, between Kamala Harris going to an abortion clinic, Biden saying, "No, actually, we're not going to do anything at the border," and this—if they're not intending to run to the left and just run a base election, they're really screwing it up. But that's clearly what they're intending to do.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps they've bought their own rhetoric, and they really do think that just saying January 6th and abortion is going to work. But irrespective of whether it should work, it doesn't seem to be working. So I found this on its own terms infuriating, but I also find it politically inexplicable. Mm-hmm. Again, I understand what he thinks he's doing, but I don't understand why he thinks he needs to do it. And I've honestly started to wonder whether they're getting some feedback that I don't know about that is yielding these peculiar results that, as someone who is not a moderate but is fairly in touch with what moderates think, just seems to me bizarre.
Yeah. So MBD, Hamas has taken sustained really serious blows in this Israeli military campaign. But the larger play and larger strategy is, you know, you embed yourself in this urban environment. Israel comes after you. It's just, you know, this is the worst kind of of warfare. Civilians are going to be harmed. You're going to do everything you can within your power to maximize civilian casualties in order to turn international opinion against Israel. And here we are, you know, with a major American political party being totally played by this strategy in a way that would have been shocking. You know, if you told Democrats on October 8th that this is where they'd be, they would have said, don't smear us this way. But here we are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, there's a lot going on. I mean, I've said over and over again on Twitter and on this podcast, I really believe that this opinion cascade on the left on Israel is the most consequential political development of the year, and probably as consequential as the election. Schumer is utterly fooling himself, in my opinion. If he thinks he can translate or speak to what's happening on the left by being anti-Bibi. I mean, Barack Obama was anti-Bibi. And being anti-Bibi is a thing if you, like, were writing for the New York Review of Books in 2015 or 2017. Maybe being anti-Bibi was, like, a fashionable opinion. That is not going to satisfy the left. Neither is this stupid peer in Gaza going to satisfy the left. They want the United States to force Israel into a ceasefire, or they want the United States to abandon Israel the way, you know, 26 out of 27 EU member states would abandon Israel.
Schumer and company are hoping that Bibi is a proxy for that sentiment. You can say, see, we're really anti-Bibi.
This is not going to work at all, right? It's like fooling yourself into thinking that the only thing Democrats object to about the Republican Party is Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just not it. You're missing the point in a fundamental way. And again, I think this is a disaster for Democrats because they're letting a very small but highly influential minority of a minority influence their party's policy and expressions on this, and bouncing them into this muddled middle where they're basically showing no leadership whatsoever. You know, there's no clarity to their position on Israel. I think it's a tremendous mistake. And, you know, this issue might cost Joe Biden the White House.
Yeah. So that's a segue to my exit question to you. First, Charlie, the Gaza war in November will hurt, help, or really have no effect on Joe Biden's chances?
Hurt.
Maddie.
Yeah, I think it will hurt, but the more fundamental issue is his age.
Immediate.
It will hurt. It will hurt. I mean, a lot of young voters turned out to get rid of Trump in 2020, and they're not going to turn out for Biden again because they're buying into this genocide Joe stuff from the fever swamps in Europe.
Yeah, it'll
hurt. Two-sided, right? Because there's also people who are appalled by his vacillating and may stay home.
Yeah, that's exactly the point I was going to make. Yeah, it's either going to hurt him among young progressives and progressives generally, or hurt him in the middle, or maybe both.
Or
right?
Both.
That's probably both at the moment. And then just the war, one hopes, will be over well before November, but just this terror attack and the war and the conflict generally will have played into, among other events around the world, the sense that things are out of control, which will also hurt Biden. So this is a hurt locker. With that, let's go to our second sponsor this episode. If you're considering the pros and cons of different cookware brands, you should know that Made In has more of the pros. Pros like Tom Colicchio, Nancy Silverton, Brooke Williamson, and many other professional chefs who all trust their cooking to Made In cookware. Fact is, Made In has a long-standing relationship with professional chefs. The company evolved from a 100-year-old kitchen supply business and works with multi-generational makers to craft each piece. They make exactly what demanding chefs are looking for, including a wide selection of curated products from carbon steel to stainless clad, plus plateware, glassware, and much more. But perhaps the biggest pro is that Maiden is sold online and delivered to your door, all for a fraction of the price of other top brands. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, invest in Maiden cookware. Once you try it, you'll be pro Maiden too. Now, right now, editors, listeners, get 10% off full-pressed items from Maiden. For full details, visit maideincookware.com/editors. That's maideincookware.com/editors. We have Maiden cookware here in the Lowry household, and it really is tremendous stuff. It actually gives me pleasure. I'm not making this up. It gives me pleasure every time I use a Maiden pan. It just feels so good in your hand. It's just well-crafted, cooks well, and very importantly, is easy to clean. So, Maddie, big event in Britain, where they're moving away from puberty blockers, which is another sign that rationality is beginning to take hold in terms of the treatment of gender-confused youths. What do you make of it?
Yeah, so this was spun as the NHS bans puberty blockers, but in fact, the NHS has already done that in June of 2023. What this recent guidance did, or rules rather, is it made clear that the existing loopholes were being tightened. So, for example, there are exceptional cases where a minor can be prescribed puberty blockers, but they will now need to go through a panel and of multidisciplinary experts, and really it's just going to effectively be a ban for most people struggling with gender dysphoria. What's happened in the UK is really just the power of public scrutiny. After journalists started looking into this and whistleblowers from the Gender Youth Clinic started coming forward, the public was confronted with the bare facts of what was going on and started to express real concern, outrage, over what is clearly just a medical scandal. The NHS had initially based its guidelines on WPATH. This is the World Professional Health Association, Transgender Health, sorry. And they're completely just not a credible organisation at all. There's recently been a big leak, an internal leak of their files, just a bunch of clinical activists who have no idea what they're doing, messing around with things that shouldn't be messed around with. And the UK has responded to say correctly that we don't have the evidence to be doing this. People who have been harmed, such as Kira Bell, who was the young woman who was prescribed puberty blockers and then went on to have another surgical change and took cross-sex hormones as well. And she has spoken very forthrightly about the damage done to her. This has just changed hearts and minds in the UK. People don't want this stuff. They can see it for what it is. And unfortunately, America is very behind the curve.
Yeah, MBD, I always go back to one of your most prescient moments. It was a dinner in New York City. We were talking about this years ago now, and you said that what's going to change the momentum for this trans stuff is lawsuits and people saying, how could you have, let me or persuaded me to do this to my body, this irrevocable change that has blighted my life in all sorts of ways. And that's come to pass, but it's come to pass more in other parts of the world, particularly Europe, than in the United States. And usually Europe is leading the way in these bad social trends rather than pulling back ahead of us.
Yeah, well, I think Europe has an advantage in a way, because, the United States has elements of free market healthcare, although not the full thing for sure. And so we have a kind of wild west as far as, the ability to open up a gender clinic and then just start prescribing off-label drug use and things like that. Whereas the NHS is just much more heavily regulated.
The market screws us again, right, MBD?
Well, no, I don't want to. This is a complex issue where we're also talking about the ideological infiltration of, medical bodies which should be exercising judgment, like the AMA. But in the UK, I mean, there really is like a fixed budget, and there is a more severe rationing system that forces people to make choices and then forces people to look at the evidence, right? And and determine, you know, really whether these treatments are leading to good outcomes or bad ones that require even more intervention. And so you've seen, you know, Nordic countries keep track of, you know, post-op suicides, mm-hmm. and those numbers became alarming. You've seen, you know, the NHS, you know, track the absurd growth of demand for these surgeries, you know, that was growing by hundreds of percent per year suddenly. In the United States, there's room for that to grow, and it's taken advantage of by, like, buccaneering opportunists. You know, it's just a difference in the system where their restraints kicked in earlier. Ours are going to kick in very hard, I think, because there's an increased visibility for these detransitioners. The law hasn't forbade them from seeking medical malpractice and lawsuits. And, you know, they're eventually going to get judgments that will spook health insurers. And those health insurers will then turn to the university hospitals and tell them no more. And I just think that is how it will work in the United States. But yeah, we are way behind, you know, partly because we are a freer country, and that means we are freer to make horrible mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of horrible mistakes, Charlie, there was a piece, big piece in New York Magazine, basically saying, why would we stop kids from doing this? They have, this is freedom, and maybe they'll regret it and it's a mistake, but hey, we all, make mistakes.
Well, I think that's a good segue, Rich, because I was going to say to Michael that while I do think some of the difference he describes is indeed the product of the different health systems, I think a lot of it is cultural. I think one of the reasons that this madness has taken on such a life of its own in the United States is that America is just different than every other country, culturally. Usually that's good. We have freer speech, freer exercise of religion, we have the Second Amendment, we have more robust Fourth Amendment protections, we have lower taxes, and so on. But when peculiar cultural habits arise, America tends to push them up to 11 because we are more susceptible, and again, this is usually a good thing, to the argument, well, freedom. The National Health Service obviously plays into this, but that, in my estimation, is the biggest reason that America has gone out on a limb. And this piece that you mention in New York Magazine is a great example of that. I have seen a good deal of pushback to this piece from the left, not necessarily on the merits, not necessarily in opposition to its central holding, which is, hey, maybe children should be able to, I'll say, try to change their sex in the way anyone else should. But to the blithe way in which the author of that piece proposes that that is normal in America. That is a persuasive argument, as I say. All you need to do in many cases in America is say, but freedom. I like that, generally. But that's actually not how we treat children, is it? This is one of the big problems with that piece. It's flippant. It builds atop that intrinsic American preference for liberty, but it makes claims and assumptions about the rights of children that simply don't obtain. In reality, we don't allow children to make mistakes and then say, oops, oh well. Children are not allowed to get married or own property or buy firearms or drive. They're not allowed to get tattoos. They're not allowed to sign up for the military. They're not allowed to go to a bar and drink alcohol. Why would this be an exception? Now, if you want to make a medical case, fine. I profoundly disagree with that medical case. I think it's nonsense. I think it's built atop lies and fabrications. But if you want to argue, look, this is a medical question and we regulate medicine in this country and we have to decide whether or not we're going to permit these sorts of operations, then fine. But that's not what the author does. What the author does is gesture wildly towards this culture of liberty and then say, therefore. But it doesn't really make a great deal of sense. Because in no other circumstances would we say to a 10-year-old, oh, you think you should cut off your genitals? Sure. Well, you might regret it, but I guess we don't have a choice. We do have a choice. Charlie, this is, go on.
Yeah, if I could just add, I think you're right that this is a misunderstanding of this idea of freedom. But the other thing the author of that piece does is he wildly overestimates the ability of technology to actually do the thing that's wanted here. So at one point he says, sex is real, so is global warming. To believe in their reality is an indispensable precondition for making normative claims about them, as we know from climate activism. But the belief that we have a moral duty to accept reality just because it is real is, I think, a fine definition of nihilism. He doesn't accept that you literally cannot change your sex. And this is the fundamental problem, is that the idea that, like, as Michael says, we've got this wild west of gender clinics and people are offering the impossible. So you're right, like, part of it is we should just let kids do it because, you know, it's kind of like an extreme libertarian position. Why not? Like, kids are basically free in the same way we are. We should just let them do anything. It's also, this thing being offered is actually fundamentally an illusion. And there's a dishonesty involved in this that adds to the element of scandal.
Yeah. And it's also built around the conclusion that this is so real and such a problem that any ugliness that might be encountered along the way is presumptively worth it. You know, the way these people talk is almost how people talk during wars, where they'll say, well, yes, of course, the horrendous maiming and death and destruction and poverty that we incurred was atrocious, but what alternative did we have? Whereas most people, they read about what has happened to these children, and especially those who will speak publicly about their regrets, and they'll say, well, maybe we shouldn't do that then. There's a fanaticism in the conclusion that doesn't seem to be moved even in the slightest by evidence to the contrary. So I agree with you there, but I do think this is the age-old problem in free countries, especially profoundly free countries, is sometimes liberty moves into license. And until the arguments are advanced properly, they can often look the same. And that's what's happening here.
Well, Charlie, I just want to add one little thing. I think you're exactly right. I think it's a perennial human problem in that, you know, liberty for human beings has been, you know, the grand historical pursuit of liberty has been a runway away from absolute poverty and scarcity towards more abundance and more choice and more protection from the elements, you know, of the natural world. And yet, and somehow I think that fools a number of people are thinking that they're able to escape human nature itself, like the nature that's imposed on us as creatures. And, you know, that's what this conflict is really about, right? And like, America is, you know, a kind of unique testing ground for that. And I think you were right to focus on the cultural stuff. Like, you don't get the People's Temple in Switzerland, right? Like, there you just get a vicar who wants, you know, maybe more welfare spending. But here you get revolutionary suicide and the Hale Bopp comic cult.
So, Maddie, what did you make of Biden's statement on Next Benedict, this case down in Oklahoma, a trans person who is bullied and commits suicide, and this has become a real cause? And, of course, this is an argument they make all the time, right? That everything that's been said on this segment of this podcast plays into this culture of self-harm and suicide among trans people, so you have to accept every one of the progressive left's claims, or you're happy with trans people killing themselves.
Yeah, well, this is a classic example of something where nobody's really paused to wait for the facts, and they've just gone straight full steam ahead with their narrative. So this was a 16-year-old girl who had an altercation in a school restroom with three other girls. I think they teased her, she poured water on them, and then she alleged that they beat her. And then the next day she takes a lethal overdose of various pills, and was ruled that her death was accurately ruled as suicide. But we don't know if she was bullied for being non-binary, as she identified. We don't know the nature of the altercation. We really don't know anything beyond those facts I've just given you. In fact, the New York Times report quite responsibly says as much. And yet you have the White House and the Human Rights Campaign making this about the dangers of LGBT, facing LGBT youth. You know, we've got the kind of bathrooms policy element in this story as well. Same thing happened in 2014 with a teenager called Joshua Alcorn, who sadly killed himself and posted a suicide note on Tumblr, I think it was, sort of saying that he was transgender and his parents didn't accept him. And then again, the same thing happened. Nobody actually waited to establish the facts. In fact, a lot of people who'd known Joshua had never even heard his female name, Layla. That was a complete news to them. He'd been living this kind of online life, talking with activists. His parents didn't know the full extent of what was going on. It was obviously a very tragic time for them, and people just rushed to politicize it. It's dishonest. These things happen and are seized upon by activists in a very horrible way. And I think that this is just a case where when people bring these things up, you have to say, what is your evidence that this is what caused this? Please provide me with the facts, because they have not yet been reported.
So Charlie Cook asked questions. You've asked it before. We are winning the trans debate at the moment. Yes or no?
Yes.
MBD?
Yeah, we're winning.
Maddie?
Yes, in key areas such as the sports issue, and I think children as well. But I do worry that this language of discrimination, like we see with this recent case of the 16-year-old who killed herself, if they find a way to kind of make that case and make it often enough, and people it takes people further away from what the debate is actually about, then we do risk losing ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the answer is yes, but I accept your caveat. With that, let's hear from our third sponsor this episode, Moink. Charlie.
From small family farms to your dining table, Moink gives you access to the freshest, sustainably sourced meat and fish, all while supporting American family farms. And you can join me and help save the family farm and get access to that highest quality meat on earth when you join the Moink movement today. And I'm trying to think how long I have been getting Moink. I think really from the first time they ever sent me a box, probably the first time I ever read one of these ads, I signed up. We've been Moink customers since, and we haven't regretted it for a single second. It is delicious. Moink delivers grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork and chicken, and sustainable wild-caught Alaskan salmon straight to your door. Moink farmers farm like our grandparents did, and as a result, Moink meat tastes like it should, because the family farm does it better. The Moink difference is a difference you can taste, and you can feel good knowing that you're helping family farms stay financially independent. Here's how it works. You choose the meat that's delivered in every box, like ribeyes, chicken breasts, pork chops, salmon fillets, and so much more. And you can cancel at any time, but of course you will not want to. Shark Tank host Kevin O'Leary called Moink's bacon the best bacon he's ever tasted. My six-year-old agrees. And Ring doorbell founder Jamie Siminoff jumped at the chance to invest in Moink. If you want to become a Moink subscriber, you can do so by signing up at moinkbox.com/editors. That's moinkbox.com/editors. And if you do, you will get free bacon for a year. That's 1 year of the best bacon you'll ever taste, but it is for a limited time only, and only if you go to moinkbox.com/editors.
Thank you so much, Charlie. Let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you previewed your dad's visit. And how did it go?
It went really well. It was really pleasant. I'm really grateful for cheap travel in the modern world, much cheaper than it was when even I was young. And, you know, we just spent the weekend where he could dote on his grandkids. And then at night, he and I would go out for a drink, and I'd learn stories from his youth that I'd never heard before. So it was quite a good time, and vows to do it again as soon as possible.
Awesome. So, Maddie, you guys have been watching Designated Survivor.
Yeah, so we started watching this just before the State of the Union. It's obviously the concept of the series is that the designated survivor, there's a terrorist attack on the Capitol, everybody dies, basically, and so the designated survivor, Kiefer Sutherland, steps in. He's not qualified for the role, but he quickly develops the qualities he needs. Anyway, we kind of watched it thinking, this is going to be terrible, this will be really funny. And yeah, it's sort of gripping in the way that, like, Law and Order is sort of gripping. So we've been hooked, and I think we're like on episode like 15 or something, which is as far as I ever get with series.
Someone should do a slightly different version where everyone is wiped out except for a totally incompetent elderly president who doesn't know what he's doing. See how
that
it
would never happen.
Yeah. Charlie took the kids to Disney.
Absolutely. My now soon to be 8-year-old's birthday. We asked him, what do you want to do? He said, Disney World. Of course, he is my son. We had a great time there. Did Guardians of the Galaxy roller coaster, Expedition Everest, had some hibachi in the Japan section at Epcot, and of course, got some drinks at the World Showcase. Splendid time was had by all.
Awesome. So I have been reading and just finished To Hell and Back, History of Europe from 1914 to 1949 by Ian Kershaw, Hitler biographer, and it's just this endlessly fascinating period because it's so consequential and so many things happen that you just literally can't get your head around. With that, it's time for editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece by Barry O'Halloran about the two Irish proposed constitutional changes that voters overwhelmingly and very surprisingly rejected, despite them being supported by all the parties in government and most of the parties in opposition and all of the government-funded NGOs. I think it's Barry's piece really gets at why this could be a momentous and transformational moment in what had been a very sleepy Irish politics.
Maddie, what's your pick?
My pick is a Corner Post by Caleb Barch on the movie Poor Things, and she says Hollywood, by honoring Poor Things, Hollywood shows its cultural poverty. I reviewed this movie. I was like blown away by it. I thought I was dazzled by its technical brilliance, its cleverness, originality, and I think it did actually deserve the Oscars that it won. But Kayla makes a really good case that I probably neglected, that it does advance a very horrible view of the world, kind of view of womanhood in particular. So I was left feeling ashamed after I read her post. I was like, I can't believe I praised this horrible, immoral movie.
why didn't you feel that way after my...
Well, yours is just wrong on that.
All right. Little detail. Charlie, what's your pick?
My pick is Noah Rothman's Chuck Schumer's Problem is with Israel, not Netanyahu, in which Noah points out that, leaving aside everything else we've discussed, Schumer's proposed election would not yield any actual substantive changes, in that he seems to believe that there is a divide in Israeli politics over Hamas, and there isn't. It lays out very clearly why it is that calling for an election on the grounds that you think people should be given a choice just doesn't make sense even on its own terms.
So my pick is an editorial, unsigned editorial, titled Michael Mann Owes Us $1 Million. It's a very accurate title and this long-running case with no end that never should have been brought in the first place. We won a partial victory against Mann way back when, and this thanks to this anti-SLAPP statute, which gives us the right to recover some of our legal fees. when various other things had happened. Those things had now happened, and we have filed to get our recompense there. And it's actually a little bit more than $1 million. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Geo podcast, and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Geo Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Donors Trust, Made In, and Moink. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.